welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today, a little later in the show, we're going to be talking about Oscar Lopez Rivera and a lot of what his release means for political prisoners in the United States and political struggle in the United States. We're also going to be talking with Barrett Brown, former imprisoned journalist himself, about similar issues involving Chelsea Manning and Julian Assange. And on that note, before we move on, after 7 years of what the UN High Commissioner on Human Rights stated was an arbitrary detention, Swedish prosecutors have dropped their case against Julian Assange for rape, raising the possibility that Assange could finally walk out of the Ecuadorian embassy in London as a free man. And while we should say at the outset, charges of rape are almost never proven wrong, and the situation with Assange is the geopolitical exception to the normal rule, and certainly this case should do nothing to lessen the fact that serious charges of sexual abuse have to be investigated and taken extremely seriously in every instance. It's also worth noting that even Assange's supporters here have never claimed his behavior is irreproachable, just that it was not what was being alleged and that there was clearly a different motive, and Assange himself was always willing to stand trial. And with all that, it seems fairly clear that Assange was targeted by Sweden as part of a broader effort by Western governments to silence and discredit WikiLeaks, who has ripped the veil off many of their closest held secrets, war crimes, torture, and illegal spying. The case itself was quite bizarre. And the original allegations were dropped in 2010 when Swedish authorities said they could not sustain charges of rape against Assange or, I believe, any crime. And then in the heat of the conflict with the United States and WikiLeaks, the charges were subsequently and somewhat mysteriously reopened. WikiLeaks had also embarrassed the Swedish government by revealing that the government was working secretly with U.S. intelligence agencies in a way deliberately designed to avoid scrutiny from their own parliament. Germany was doing the same. So there's some evidence there maybe why they were revived. One of those prevented as a victim of Assange has stated quite clearly that she felt intensely pressured by police into filing some sort of criminal charges and felt, quote unquote, railroaded by the police. This is very relevant because it seems the reason both accusers originally wanted the advice of police was to figure out how to get Assange to take some sort of STD test, not to get him arrested for rape. So clearly from the very beginning, powerful forces seem willing to manipulate these women and their actual experiences in an attempt to get Assange. It also seems clear that roughly around the same time, the United States was preparing a secret grand jury to try Assange for WikiLeaks' release of U.S. diplomatic cables if they could get their hands on him. Seems likely that the plan was to force him to Sweden where he could be extradited to the United States. Assange said again and again he'd be more than willing to be questioned in Sweden on these charges if they would assure him that he would not be extradited, a promise Sweden would not give, nor would the United Kingdom. Assange offered to give testimony in the embassy or some other remote way. That was also for most of the time of this case, completely denied. And again, this is on the basis of a case that was reopened with essentially no evidence, making the behavior of the prosecutor seem unavoidably political. With ample opportunity to question Assange on the actual charges they claimed to be investigating, they refused. Instead, they seemed focused on concocting a scenario which would force Assange to leave his embassy refuge in London. The bulk of the Swedish legal community had spoken out against the case, seeing it as a perversion of justice. It was clear that if they wanted to try Assange in Sweden for rape, he was willing to stand trial. All they had to do was say they wouldn't extradite him to the U.S., which seems like a pretty easy trade-off if what the Swedish prosecutor felt so strongly about was making sure that someone they felt was so guilty of such a serious crime was convicted. And really, all the evidence points to the fact that the resurrected charges were based not on facts, but on an attempt by the high levels of several Western governments to get Assange to the U.S., where he'd be thrown in some dungeon on some pretext, and they hoped WikiLeaks silenced forever. All the better to hide their massive war crimes, crimes against humanity, and mass violations of privacy rights around the world. Even worse, they manipulated the very serious issues of sexual abuse and rape in a way that makes it easier for those who constantly accuse women of quote-unquote making it up to have that claim sustained. And all this just to get Assange. The UK is now claiming there's some outstanding legal issues, but it seems like now, after the rape charges have been dropped for the second time, it's possible Assange may go free. Donald Trump, 45th president of the United States, will take off in Air Force One today to travel to Saudi Arabia for his first trip abroad as president of the United States. The Saudis are planning on a hardcore rollout of the red carpet with a massive two-day extravaganza that even includes a country music concert by Toby Keith. The Saudis have invited the leaders of almost every Arab and Muslim majority country to come pay homage to Trump and the king and to host discussions about the direction of U.S. policy in the region. Saudi Arabia also wants to reportedly invest $40 billion in U.S. infrastructure and is standing ready to buy huge amounts of arms to enrich U.S. military contractors to curry favor. As many reports have noted, the Saudis view Trump as an ally because he's also skeptical of Iran, which Saudi Arabia hates, and they expect Trump with the right incentives to back the Gulf monarchy agenda in the region, including mass murder and famine being forced on Yemen. The New York Times reports the feelings more or less seem to be mutual between the two parties, relating that Jared Kushner personally intervened in the $100 billion plus arms deal that will be announced on the trip to ask Lockheed Martin to lower the price on some high-priced weapon systems to make sure that the deal went through. The media also reported that the Saudis have made a strategic decision to totally ignore the Trump team's intense Islamophobia in the hopes that their desire to crush Iran will lead to a deeper alliance with the kingdom. Which is why it makes slightly more sense why Stephen Miller, one of Trump's closest aides, is writing the speech that allegedly is supposed to build bridges with the Muslim world. Miller was the architect, though, of the Muslim ban, or let me say it like this, the ban of people that was designed to create the perception that they were banning all Muslims. Once headed up a group that the Southern Poverty Law Center also referred to as an anti-Muslim hate group. He once called one of Islam's five pillars being aimed at global rule by quote-unquote radical Islam, and Miller has collaborated in the past with notorious white supremacist Richard Spencer as well. And yes, now this is the guy writing a speech that allegedly will not demonize all Muslims. No problem, though, because it's obviously all theater. The Saudis are actually trying to provide cover for Trump's anti-Muslim bigotry in the hopes that he will return the favor by endorsing their expansionist desires in the region. You scratch my back, and I'll scratch yours, I guess. Joe Lieberman is back from the political dead, apparently heading up the short list of candidates to head up the FBI in the wake of the firing of James Comey. Yes, that Joe Lieberman. The conservative Democrat who was Al Gore's running mate in 2000 and almost reprised the role for Republican John McCain in 2008. Lieberman, from the very beginning, has been an aggressive neocon hawk and really pushed for the Iraq War. He also played a role not only fighting against single payer in the Affordable Care Act negotiations, but went even further and tanked the expansion of Medicare by allowing those over 55 to buy into the program. Why, you might ask? Well, it appears, based on reporting from Ezra Klein, he did it solely to punish more liberal members of the Congress who were enthusiastic about the plan. This actually could have resulted in lower premiums for everyone, so literally tens of millions of people are paying higher insurance premiums because of Lieberman's centrist extremism. Of course, many on the Hill are already predicting he will be quickly ushered in as FBI director should he be nominated, since the good old Boys and Girls Club on Capitol Hill seems to never want to turn on their own. Case in point, Jeff Sessions. It would be a strong choice for Trump by dividing Democrats and giving Republicans some respite from the idea that Trump only has loyalists overseeing the Russiagate situation. So don't be surprised if it happens. Just remember his record when Democrats are fawning all over him in confirmation hearings. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined here to continue our conversation by Barrett Brown. Barrett's an award-winning journalist. He was the founder of Project PM. In January 2015, he was sentenced to 63 months in federal prison for being really a journalist in many ways, which is a topic that we want to turn to in terms of the demonization of a lot of things that are going on now. And we are very happy to be joined again by Barrett Brown. Thank you so much for joining the show.
No problem.
So the sort of, I guess, late-breaking news, I don't know if it was late-breaking news that came out this morning that I certainly want your thoughts on are the charges against Julian Assange in Sweden have been dropped. There's still some pending issues in the UK, so he won't be leaving the embassy right away. But it looks like perhaps Julian Assange could be freed after, I think it was 7 years of more or less imprisonment there in the Ecuadorian embassy. Your thoughts on this development?
Well, that was the original sort of you know, justification for harassing Assange for, you know, what is it now, like 5, 6, 7, 8 mm-hmm. years since that began. So that's, you know, obviously very telling. You know, they had made a pretty strong case that this was a, you know, just did not amount to much. And, you know, he took a lot of flack for it. It did what it was may have been intended to do, which was to damage his reputation, to minimize his soft power. You know, I have no idea exactly what the actual circumstances were, but it's very clear that, you know, given Karl Rove's connection to the country at that time, given his influence to that administration and a few other factors that came up, that there was, you know, that there was a degree of manipulation here, Swedish justice system. So that's obviously a reassuring development. You know, on the other hand, of course, you know, they're both Sarah Harrison and Assange are now concerned about the U.S. getting more directly involved. And, you know, we'll have to see what happens with that.
Absolutely. And Laura Poitras' new film coming out has sort of raised a lot of those issues in another way. I mean, it seems like this is an interesting week for this to be happening as well, with Chelsea Manning also being released from prison. The two things happening in 1 week seems interesting and fortuitous. But, I mean, I wonder if – and I don't know if we can really say this, but I mean, having Assange now perhaps at least seemingly to some degree vindicated, Chelsea Manning being freed and I think very significantly vindicated, if perhaps some of these tactics that arose to try to have, I thought, a chilling effect on people looking to critique government corporate policies, if maybe there's sort of a crack in that facade and maybe it's a little less effective than they had hoped for in the original chargings.
Well, what's really helpful is over the last year and a half, in large part due to the U.S. election, there have been cracks in the facade of the U.S. justice system and the U.S. law enforcement system. You have both parties having been at each other's throats over whether the Obama DOJ was corrupt and you know, was committing unprecedented failures of justice by Loretta Lynch meeting with Bill Clinton, and then, you know, after that by Comey doing several different, you know, discreet, you know, different maneuvers that seem to have benefited one part or the other. And then, of course, recent events where you had now the president calling the FBI director a liar and the FBI director essentially calling the president a liar. That hasn't sunk in yet. I think that the full extent of that, I don't think the U.S. sort of national conversation is that quick on the uptake, but eventually it will be absorbed that here we have a system in which all the mechanisms of our law enforcement have been attacked, not by anarchists or, you know, radical left-wing activists, but by presidents, senators, DNC chairman, RNC chairman. That's something that, if the implications are sort of made clear, which they have to be, because this is not again, the nation is not quick on the uptake when it comes to what they're talking about, but that does make it harder for a convincing case to be made by any prosecutor doing anything that could be remotely considered to be political, as a prosecution of activists is. You know, I don't see any reason why these fractures won't continue. You know, this is a situation that cannot be quickly resolved in any way that's satisfactory to both parties. And so you're going to have 40% of the population on one side or the other at any given time, you know, attacking the FBI, attacking the DOJ. I mean, here's the great argument I like to see made over the next few months. If Republicans in Congress are going to claim that they don't believe a memorandum written by a director of the FBI that many of them have praised in the past, then will they call for reform of the FBI? Will they no longer allow FBI memorandum to be admissible in court? So this is a great little sort of mud trap that everybody's gotten stuck in. And unfortunately, the implications of our actions as a country don't always really, you know, get much attention paid to them. But, you know, hopefully that will change this time. Hopefully people will understand the extent to which these conversations have a real meaning outside of the particular incidents.
No, I think that's a very good point. I mean, I think that certainly it seems like there's now almost like a partisan truth, and people, you praise somebody one day, but then they're on the opposite side of, you know, whatever the issue may be, certainly the Trump-Russia scandal, and then all of a sudden, you know, they're the worst scandal. I mean, Robert Mueller, who obviously had bipartisan support for years and years as FBI head, and then now all of a sudden you have some Democrats saying, well, he worked at Wilmer Hale, and Jared Kushner was one of their clients, and you know, can you really trust someone who would work at a law firm that would represent Paul Manafort? And I mean, even though there's only a handful of these major law firms that represent, you know, everyone in the 1%, I mean, I'm curious what the state of play is here to you. I mean, a lot of people are putting this out here is that it's like, quote unquote, the deep state against Trump. Some people are saying, well, it's sort of factions within, you know, elements of the state, some allied with, you know, more of the forces that support the Democrats, some more with Trump. I mean, I guess it's difficult to know, but I mean, how are you seeing sort of maybe the players behind the players in this one?
I tend to see it in the way that the originator of the term deep state tended to see it. The fellow who was a professor Berkeley and a former Clinton diplomat who popularized this term back in the 60s when he was writing about first the CIA's involvement in Southeast Asia and a lot of the sort of peripheral things that were going on there. He made it very clear in all of his books, and he's been writing for 50, 60 years, that the deep state is a term that we should use just to refer to a large trend involving that portion of the state which is not amenable to change. It's not amenable to optics among the citizenry. We can't really see what it's doing without great effort. But the deep state is not a monolith. It's an element. It's an environment. It's not a single, you know, brain operating on a single agenda. It's been the deep state's now become popular among conservatives over the past just 2 years. Just is now one of their favorite terms. Most people don't understand it. The establishment, sort of more democratic wing people who are now mocking the term deep state, don't realize where it came from. That it's been in use, you know, on a technical basis by sociologists, historians, political analysis for a number of years to refer to events in Egypt where the bureaucracy in the military is generally has been referred to by the deep state. Obviously, that was actually a mainstream newspaper writer whose, you know, recent book about 5-6 years ago was called The Deep State. So it's not a goofy like conspiracy term or over-the-top conspiracy term. Some people would like to depict it. But anyway, in this case, yes, there are factions, as there always are. Within individual institutions, there are always factions. Within the intelligence community, there are always factions at war with each other. Sometimes one is far more prevalent than the other. But, you know, that's the problem that both parties have ignored for a great deal of time, that there is a capability when you build up this very powerful intelligence bureaucracy and you give it everything it wants and you don't really mind when it lies to you, that it will sometimes come back to haunt you. And in this case, I happen to agree with the leaking that's being done, as I usually do. I'm usually in favor of leaking. And in this case, things like Michael Flynn's very bizarre and increasingly understandable behavior would not have come to light probably without leaking. So again, both parties are being disingenuous. Neither party is really engaging with the fundamentals about, you know, if it's a problem that the deep state exists, well, will the Republican Party go after it eventually? If the Democrats, you know, this has gone on. It's been in such high relief, disingenuousness and the switching of roles. You know, it's very similar to the 30s, the sort of formative years of George Orwell, when the communists and fascists and you know, even in countries like Britain, you had the right and the left switching and taking these really bizarre turns of events based on just whatever was convenient. It's really like that now, and that's the real problem.
No, absolutely interesting point there. We're going to take a quick break here on By Any Means Necessary here on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. We're going to come back with more from Barrett Brown. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
To By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. And we continue to be joined here by Barrett Brown. And Barrett, where we left off there talking a little bit about the deep state reminds me of something else here. And I think, and especially sort of as how maybe some of these scandals are relating to grassroots activists. I mean, I think you look at Assange, you look at Manning, you had sort of really exploitation of perhaps vulnerable situations, less in certain cases than others. But, you know, the journalist who turned on Chelsea, who, you know, she thought was, you know, taking her confidence in confidence, and then Assange and his personal relationships. And I think, you know, for some people, this obviously does have a chilling effect because, you know, whatever, we're all humans. We all are living our lives. We don't always do it perfectly. And it just seems like there's sort of two ways you can approach this, is you can sort of, you know, do nothing and actually be cowed. You can sort of try to be active and engaged and, you know, pushing for things you believe in and living your life and just hope it doesn't come back to haunt you. Or I guess there's like the Ralph Nader effect, which is just you try to live like a monk so that there's nothing they can really find on you, but that seems somewhat unsustainable. And I mean, I wonder just where you fall on that sort of spectrum of how people should approach, I guess, I don't know, I hate to call them like vulnerabilities. I think it's a lot of just like your life, but how the intersection of the personal and the political and the conflicts with these sorts of powerful forces plays out.
I myself, I do the opposite of living like a monk. I always make it very clear that I'm a degenerate. That way it makes you sort of invulnerable from like any revelation. Like no one's ever going to like get pictures of me like smoking crack in a basement and have that matter. No, they'd be like, oh, look, there's Barrett Brown smoking crack in a basement again. He used to do that back in Brooklyn. He used to write about it. So, you know, I'm pretty, you know, again, just there are certain personalities, quite frankly, that get away with things that other personalities don't. Kennedy's were a good example. I'm another example. So that's never concerned me. But again, it really does depend on how you handle things. If you come off as an honest person who is willing to engage and explain these things and say, yes, I'm a human being and this is, you know, nothing human is alien to me and, you know, et cetera, I think you will rightfully be dealt with as a human being if you do something wrong, as opposed to being dealt with as a two-dimensional character, like a lot of these politicians, you know, essentially act. So it's all, I mean, honesty is the best policy.
No, I think that's certainly my mom would agree with that for sure. That I think speaks a lot to you know, those who do get quote unquote revealed and those who don't. I want to turn to the shadow brokers issue here with the WannaCry malware attack. I mean, really, it's sort of massive worldwide assault here coming from these cyber weapons that, I guess, we're taken from the NSA or whatever, who knows the exact sort of reality around it. But I mean, it does just seem like it really reinforces yet again, and I know we've talked about this before, that I mean, the existence and the proliferation of these weapons by the CIA and the NSA and their, you know, zeal to keep every backdoor they find open to exploit in and of itself, it has to be one of the most dangerous phenomena in the world right now.
Absolutely. I mean, again, here's a great example that will not be picked up on by the press as a whole, that we should not be creating all of these extraordinarily just force multiplier weapons that anyone can use and keeping them in within the confines of intelligence community that is not very good at keeping their stuff secret. This was going on back in 2011 after the H.P. Gary hack and Team Themis, this conspiracy against journalists and activists was exposed. We obviously acquired a number of emails showing what this sector does. It's this private intelligence sector that does a lot of this work for the government when they want zero days, when they want, you know, malware, when they want, you know, dark, you know, black propaganda done. In-game systems, a great example, was a firm with ties to the NSA run by a former criminal hacker who had been turned by the Pentagon back in the early 90s, Chris Rowland, I believe. They had all these exploits that they acquired, and they were selling, for some reason, the ability to take over computers in, like, French airports, for instance. Really, really bizarre. And, you know, luckily we were able to come across this and forwarded these emails to Bloomberg, and they dug some digging and put out a great story on it. And they afterwards went out and said, oh, we're not doing this anymore. We're sorry. And that was it. I mean, it's just, we're not capable as a citizenry of reacting to these things in the proper way. When something like this happens and this massive crime is committed because the NSA has created these things they really don't need and they get stolen, as has happened over and over again, starting with the Aurora attacks by the Chinese and moving on to things like Anonymous and moving on to criminal just mundane criminal actors in Russia and China who could take these things. You know, it's, at some point we need to say, no, you can't do this anymore. You cannot create all this bizarre malicious malware that you're definitely going to be using against U.S. citizens and activists anyway, and that foreign dictatorships are going to acquire. Like, they just will. This points to a larger problem, is that, you know, now that it's happened, well, will there be any consequences? No, there absolutely will not be any consequences. There will not be congressmen getting, you know, getting a chance to bring this to national, you know, consideration. It just won't happen. That is the great fatal flaw in this republic, is that we are not capable of paying attention to all of the really important sort of things that we've unlocked from Pandora's box over the years.
And I mean, is there any expectation after – it just seems like yet again, even though they work so closely with the NSA and the CIA and others, the Silicon Valley, yet again the government agencies, you know, really sort of giving them a black eye with their customers at the very least as it concerns privacy. I don't even know why I'm asking this to some degree. But, I mean, can we have any hope that it's like a rebel faction emerging amongst Silicon Valley at some point? Like does some one of these Silicon Valley types eventually just get super fed up with the fact that no matter how much they cooperate, the government is still, you know, putting in back doors and, you know, unsecuring their technology and stuff like that? Or is that sort of interpenetration between the public and the private there too far gone?
I think just based on what I've seen, what I've been able to see, I don't see a moral rebellion occurring in Silicon Valley anytime soon. These are not people. I mean, look, the country on the whole is a country of moral cowards. I think the Silicon Valley people may even be worse than the average, based on what I hear from people who have worked out there. So, no, I don't think that's the problem at all. I mean, every once in a while, you'll have somebody who will leak things, you know, who will have, you know, take the opportunity to point to a dangerous trend, and you know, but that's going to be few and far between, and it's not going to matter that much. I mean, really, even major crucial leaks can take on the news cycle for a couple of days, and that's it. And you know, it doesn't hit that threshold of public outrage that then hits the threshold for congressional action. And even congressional action is rarely wholly successful, and that's especially the case when you have this kind of Congress. So again, that's the underlying problem, is that we don't have the mechanisms in place to actually keep us from crooning off a cliff in many different ways. That's why the emphasis has to be on building new sort of counter institutions that actually work.
Counter institutions, along with, if you could just sketch out to some degree, I think that's an interesting point, what that potentially could look like.
Well, when I was released from prison about 6 months ago, I mentioned this to Wired. Wired did a profile on me, and I announced that I was going to be building a pursuant system, which is a sort of mechanism for mass collaboration online. It's something, it's a framework whereby, you know, thousands of people can enter this sort of, you know, online server universe, sort of space, and without any prior relationships, organize along lines we call process democracy, whereby anybody can create this little entity we call pursuance and set its perimeters and set its goals and determine exactly how it grows, you know, what it does. People can join, you know, knowing exactly full well what they're joining. And these pursuances, as they grow, they can connect to each other. They can collaborate. They can create, you know, sort of a, without giving up independence, if they don't want to, there's a number of ways they can do this. But essentially, we will be growing oppositional superorganisms, structures involving hundreds of people each that are able to share information and collaborate in ways vastly more efficient than we see now. I mean, we're still doing things the way they were done several hundred years ago in terms of human organization for the large part. The internet has not quite yet been appreciated for what it really is. There's a lot of sort of our perceptions of it are kind of wrapped up in the what's been done in the past and the sort of some mundane things we see about the internet, that it's, oh, it's for dating and it's for this and it's very silly. You know, it's very early days in the information age, and there needs to be a lot of focus on, if not the pursuant system that we're creating, this larger trend of, look, the internet allows individuals to collaborate with anyone else on the planet on a huge scale for the first time in human history. And all of our institutions developed in an entirely different environment in which collaboration was vastly limited to your geographical proximity or sort of controlled by existing institutions that kind of mediated that collaboration. So these factors that are going to be very important in the 21st century, which are we're already seeing are important in different ways over the past 10 years. They need to be the main focus of those people who are honest and decent and favor liberty and favor an open society, because we're not winning the battle for a decent society. We're losing it. And that has to change, and it's not going to change through just doing the same thing over and over again.
Well, I think certainly that is the definition of insanity there, and so certainly always perhaps maybe an important inflection point to reexamine some things that we're some of our practices. And, you know, one thing in terms of certainly at least the battle of information, I'm curious your thoughts on sort of switching back a little bit here. You know, one thing that sort of underlines a lot of these conversations about especially everything happening in the White House or whatever that drives me crazy, I've been talking about this all week, is the veneration of these, like, the head of the FBI or the head of the CIA or whatever it may be. And it's always, like, no matter what the record says, like, everyone was like, you know, when James Comey's dismissed, everyone's saying James Comey is the greatest person on earth. So I just Googled James Comey Islamophobia just to see if I could find something bad, like, you know, sort of confirmation bias. But, like, the third story I found was how he was saying Muslim FBI agents need more scrutiny because of their religion or whatever. But she wasn't saying that about, you know, whatever, white FBI agents who, you know, could have ties to white supremacists. I mean, so in 30 seconds, I found something that was, you know, certainly tarnished his white knight image, but it's like all the power of all the major media in the world, and no one can bring up that this guy's been controversial on 5 or 6 different levels in his tenure. I mean, it really just seems like that in and of itself is so highly problematic.
Yeah, that brings up two problems. The larger problem is that news gathering is very haphazard. I've been presented as a security expert on, like, Bloomberg conferences, and I'm not a security expert. I've been on, then like a week later, I'll be presented with something else. It's just, there's all this, it's very easy for experts or pseudo experts to get on TV based on some just brief glimpse by a producer saying, oh, this person's an expert, let's get them on. They don't care. I mean, what does it matter to them? And that extends to everything. That extends to all news gathering. It's why it's so haphazard. But the other problem is that, yes, the FBI has always been very good at projecting this image despite everything. I mean, despite the fact that Congress had to go investigate the FBI, citizens actually had to break into the FBI's offices to steal documents to show COINTELPRO, to show that they were engaged in the greatest criminal conspiracy in the country, which was a conspiracy against liberty, against privacy and democracy, a conspiracy against black Americans, where all black colleges and all black college students were by policy to be surveilled, all of them. That didn't come out until a few years ago. But, you know, I mean, just even today, the FBI, I mean, the senators and congressmen you see at these panels, you see when Comey testifies, praising him and saying, we know the FBI is crown jewel. Well, they don't really know these things. They haven't gone and done a study and looked at, well, let's have a study done of all the cases and let's say, when were there allegations of misconduct, blah, blah. They don't really know, but, I mean, they want to believe it. And it's obviously more politically viable, you know, not to say, hey, oh, the FBI is a dirty bunch of pigs. You know, you can't really say that from the bench there in the well of Congress. It's not a viable thing to say. So they say it, and a lot of people believe it, and they've never dealt with the FBI, even anecdotally. So beyond anecdotes, you know, we have a lot of information about what the FBI has done, the way they've wasted resources by cultivating mentally ill people and trying to get them to commit terrorist acts so they can arrest them and say they've pulled a terrorist act. We've seen how they handle activists. We've seen how they go after people's family members. And it's actually like went after my mother, of course, trying to get me to cooperate. It's very, very common in all of these things. You don't have to be indicted by the FBI to understand them. You can go and look. There's a lot of data that's been done. So that speaks to a larger problem, is that we're not serious as a country about having our representatives talk about reality in terms that are not crazy. I mean, that is a crazy depiction of reality to say that we know that all FBI agents are this. And someone said to a reporter or another congressman, have you ever met an FBI agent? Intending to meet that if you had met an FBI agent, you would know that all of them are always honest. And we might as well just not even have courts. We might as well just have the FBI, because, I mean, they're just sterling people. We're wasting a lot of time and energy with the courts. So, yeah, that's a big problem. It's what I see identified as a serious problem, because it means that activists and even journalists who are considered to be adversarial to the state can be pursued. And even when, as in my case, huge problems are just arise that are just you know, come out or revealed through testimony and through, you know, clear contradictions and you know, them saying I'm writing about the government, I'm being mean to the government, bizarre shit on the stand, that's public. Even on those occasions, nothing happens. because they already know the FBI is his fine bunch of fellows.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. It's a confirmation bias situation if you just assume that, sort of they must be out for the best despite a couple rogue actors. And it really does, so to speak, to sort of how people consume news, because, I mean, there's so much out there that's actually relatively easily available. You know, it's just often selectively presented. But even the story that just came out on The Intercept this week about how they made this, like, 100-hour documentary, this fake documentary against the Bundy Ranch people. And I'm just like, hey, no love lost from me to the Bundy Ranch people, but this is so absurd that they're trying to trick them, you know, in Las Vegas suites, which cost tens of thousands of dollars of our taxpayer money to convince them they're Hollywood media moguls. I mean, it's just insane.
That's something that, you know, it was on The Intercept, and yeah, obviously this is not a normal news cycle, so it didn't really get the oxygen it needed to. But even if this is a regular news cycle, even if this is 1997 and all is well, that kind of story would not have gotten the attention it needed. I mean, that's an extraordinary opportunity for us, for our producers and our editors, to talk about the FBI for a little bit, to do those retrospectives or those broader stories and say, hey, everyone says the FBI is full of Boy Scouts, but here's something that kind of indicates the exact opposite, and it comes after lots and lots of other incidents indicating the exact opposite, so maybe we should write a story about that. That again goes into the key media bias, which is not ideological. It's chronological. It's, oh, has anything happened lately? Is there some kind of incident we can use? And then, you know, obviously a couple of days later, that incident, it's old, it's gone. You can't really use it anymore. It's not news, even though it is, even though it's news to people every single day, because the FBI is our morally unassailable national police force that has a history of going after activists, going after people who history proves right. That's its real reputation among actual people who know what the FBI is. And so, again, all these institutions, just because of their deficits, sort of create this interplay, and there is no real change for that reason.
I mean, it just seems like the for-profit nature of the thing is really getting the best of a lot of these people now, where, I mean, to some degree, it's being taken advantage of by these agencies, because if you can leak anything that is about Trump and Russia, it doesn't even matter. If you are a quote-unquote senior official, you can just tell them anything, and they'll run with it, and they won't quote you, and it's all this, it seems like it's almost like this sort of one-upsmanship and gamesmanship to be like the quote-unquote top news source without any real thought of what it's doing to the credibility of just the idea of truth and facts.
Well, I mean, I think that the truth and facts thing, I think that's, there's no rescuing that. I mean, I don't think, you know, that's, it's not the FBI's fault. We didn't start the fire on that one. I mean, Fox News put the nail in the coffin of just even gestures towards decency back in the late 90s. Breitbart's finished it off. In between that, we had a lot of incompetence and just, and moral failings on CNN and MSNBC and a lot of the newspapers. You have people going to journalism school and they're not learning, you know, what they really need to know, because you can't teach that. You can't teach the ability to look at something and determine if it's important. And that's why you have this herd mentality. That's why you have, a degree of threshold has to be hit, and then everybody covers it. Because everybody suddenly realizes, oh, that guy's covering it. What is that? You know, it's not just the FBI here in terms of the leaking. Leaking is done as a matter of course by all parties involved, including us. You know, it's not a situation where, you know, leaks are very popular, regardless of who's providing them. At this point, the leaks all look bad for Trump, because Trump and his administration clearly have done a number of things that they do not want known. I mean, that was clear a year ago with Roger Stone, Paul Manafort. The fact that there's been some spurious allegations here and there, and the fact that there's fake experts like that Louise Minch around, doesn't change that. There was just really a story here.
Right. I think we might have to leave it there at this moment. I apologize there, Barrett. We're going to have to call time on this one, but certainly always appreciate you jumping on the show. Always a great job. Always a great conversation with you there. We're going to take another break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And we are very happy to be joined in this conversation with Matt Myers, a native of New York City, and he's based there as well. He's an educator, activist, and author. He's the World Resistors International Africa Support Network Coordinator and a UN representative of the International Peace Research Association. Matt, thank you so much for joining the show.
A real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You know, and I know that you do a lot of work on political prisoners. We had had the pleasure of speaking alongside you at the DNC in an event like that. We had this week the release of Chelsea Manning and Oscar Lopez Rivera. So I wanted to dig into that a little bit. I mean, it was interesting, especially reflecting on Oscar's release. I don't know if it was the word I'm looking for is poignant or telling, or I don't know. But to have his case be elevated at a time where, based on this debt crisis, the colonial nature of Puerto Rico is being so clearly revealed to many people. I don't know. It just seemed like there was some universe synergy there. But your thoughts?
Well, there's always some of that. I mean, yes, the crisis in Puerto Rico is particularly intense at this moment. Yes, in a way, the colonial nature of the relationship seems more naked, more the emperor has no clothes than in many times past. But, you know, one can say that about almost every era. You know, I have enjoyed some of the folks who talk about the Trump era and say, you know, it's bad, but it's not like the only bad or even necessarily the worst bad. And we build movement and we rebuild and we build them better.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like, yes, this is a special moment. It's a special opportunity. And, you know, Oscar's release at this moment definitely affords him an incredible challenge, but also an incredible opportunity, because what we've built, you know, it's the personal and the political. It's the man who he is and the moment. But what we've built, Oscar and, you know, his supporters, grassroots, Puerto Rico-centered, but internationally, is a movement that can look towards deeper levels of decolonization unity than has been possible on that island. Mm-hmm. And I think Oscar's well aware of that, and he is challenged by it, and he's also up to the challenge.
Mm-hmm. Well, it'll be fantastic to have him out and have him as a voice. I was also thinking in a sort of similar vein about Sekou Odinga being released recently. And it just sort of seems, and I was, you know, somewhere where Eddie Conway was not that long ago, that, you know, the one thing that just seems like such a challenge in America, even when we have these victories, is there isn't sort of the idea that there are political prisoners in America is still not pushed forward the way the media reports it and so on and so forth. It's like, well, these people are in prison now for whatever reason they got out of prison. But still, it seems that there's still something of a consciousness-building struggle that really has to take place for political prisoners, just on the basis of trying to make it more obvious to people in America that there is such a thing as political prisoners in this country.
Now, we should tell the listeners, it's absolutely true, we did not prearrange that particular comment from you and the one that's going to follow, but there couldn't be a better setup. Yes, of course. For many of us, such as myself and Sekou and Oscar, you know, more deeply from the inside, but for people who have been spotlighting political prisoners for more than a decade or two, it's been a bit of an uphill battle even within the U.S. left. However, it is my joy to announce that this year's Left Forum, which, you know, is certainly not the only left space, but, it's, you know, that they tout themselves as being the largest gathering of leftists in the U.S. every year. Well, they're opening plenary on June 2nd here in New York City, but also simulcast around the country, around the world. Their opening plenary will have both Oscar and Sekou. And it is the first time in the Left Forum's history that two former political prisoners have been given that kind of plenary stature and status and spotlight. Oscar won't be in New York. He'll be doing an introductory video cast. But Sekou will be here on the panel as a regular panelist, talking about oppression and resistance, talking about political imprisonment, of course, but also talking about the Black Liberation Movements and Puerto Rican movements that both of those men have come to represent. So I don't think the battle is over, even within the left and certainly within mainstream society, what we call the progressive movement. And others, the idea that the U.S. holds political prisoners is not as clear a focus as it needs to be. look, almost every struggle around the world, and you know, part of my work was doing international solidarity and building the international solidarity for Oscar. But, you know, part of the international work always is an understanding that pretty much everywhere you go, progressive movements and certainly radical movements understand that prisoners and political prisoners especially have got to be a core focus of any truly radical movement, any radical series of demands. You know, it wasn't hard to get South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu or the former president of East Timor, José Ramos Horta, both of them Nobel Peace laureates. It wasn't hard to get them to sign on to the Oscar campaign. Archbishop Tutu has signed on to campaigns for the release of Black Panther political prisoners, Sundiata Okoli and Mutulu Shakur and others. But, you know, it wasn't hard to have these folks recognize the importance of supporting political prisoners because political prisoners were part and parcel of the South African anti-apartheid struggle or the East Timorese independence struggle. And every struggle, even, you know, reformist struggles with teeth around the world understand, and certainly revolutionary struggles understand, that political prisoners have to be central. But the U.S. left has been slow and still is a little bit unclear about the importance of these elders, both as peoples who represent and have a history of movement and movement organizing, but also as a symbolic way of saying, if we won't fight back against repression, if we'll allow in some ways for that repression to hold, then this sort of shroud of fear goes throughout our movement, whether it's overt or covert, whether we feel it every day or we don't quite feel it, it's still there. And if we don't celebrate and push for and create more victories for our prisoners, then it's going to be harder to build the kind of movement we need.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it speaks very, I mean, it seems like a conjunctural moment. I'm glad you raised that just in terms of the Trump resistance, because, I mean, it almost makes me wonder, I mean, are we building a left movement or a radical, you know, anti-imperialist movement? Because I feel similarly to you in terms of sort of the lag in picking this up. And I almost feel like some of that is related to, I think, a large portion of, you know, people who conceive themselves as left in the United States, whatever the contradictions may be, is still sort of a slight American exceptionalist sort of reality, right? Like that if there is something like a Mumia Abu-Jamal, that it must just be sort of politically aberrant, you know, like this thing that's just kind of this random confluence of forces with a couple bad people who did the wrong thing. But sort of at its base, the American system is more or less set up to be good and just needs to be sort of slightly dialed this way or that way, as opposed to more of a radical in the sense of going to the root and branch sort of change.
Yeah, I think it's good points. And it is a way of not looking at political prisoners as simply yet another issue in the laundry list of issues we need to be concerned about. The political prisoners, for the most part, represent movement. You know, we have the Black Panthers' 50th anniversary celebrated this past year. And the fact that we have, you know, well over close to two dozen Panthers who have been in jail for, you know, 20, 30, 40, 40 plus. Oh, we have a few that are 50, you know, Rochelle McGee, etc. It's an extraordinary testimony to the fact that these guys inside have maintained their stalwart sense of resistance, and yet the movement outside doesn't hardly know their name. I think in this case, the Oscar case provides an important window. The 35 plus, close to 36 years that he has done behind bars were horrific, were filled with torture, including 12 years in solitary confinement, but also were involved with the most extraordinary creative grassroots movement built year after year after year on the island. So that Oscar comes out now, literally a household name. You know, there was a campaign some years ago, Oscar on the Street, where, you know, you'd see these life-size cardboard cutouts of Oscar and the spottings of his face show up there and there and everywhere. And so his face is like one of the best known Puerto Rican faces alive today. And it is about building a movement. It is about not just, ooh, the political prisoner issue. It's about understanding the movements that the Black Panthers built and why the government felt they had to destroy them through COINTELPRO and why we can't let this, that destruction continue. Obviously, it's for people who listen to a show named By Any Means Necessary, but far beyond that, it's necessary to understand that the movements that Malcolm and the movements that Martin were building, the Black liberation movements of the 60s, 70s, 80s, live on in different forms. And one way of understanding that unending thread, that resistant thread, is understanding who these prisoners are and what they represent, the way the majority of the Puerto Rican people understand who Oscar is, love him personally, wanted him to come home, but also understood that he was going to come home as he did yesterday, speaking about decolonization. Whether you're an independentista or not, you understand that the island of Puerto Rico is still, 120 years later, a colony of the U.S. And Oscar has to unite people for decolonization in various forms. And I think that connection between the political prisoners and the movements they represent has to be made, because we have to continue to build and rebuild and deepen the radical, as you say, the radical anti-imperialist movement that the prisoners represent.
Mm-hmm. And I also might sort of add there, I don't know if this is correct, so you can correct me if you think it's wrong, but perhaps a deep understanding, especially I think on the island and in the Puerto Rican diaspora, of sort of the contextualized nature of armed struggle, because I think especially with a lot of political prisoners in the United States, and this is not to say that any one person is or is not guilty or whatever, guilty is not the word I want to use, but obviously I think that's just like sort of a big stumbling block for a lot of people in supporting political prisoners. And one thing I was happy about with the Movement for Black Lives and their platform taking up the freedom of all political prisoners is the sort of fact that a lot of people are accused of committing quote-unquote violent acts, and that in and of itself being kind of a tripwire, a stumbling block that people don't necessarily want to go into because of how violent state violence or whatever is sort of perceived and promoted or not promoted in our society.
Let's be clear. Oscar came out and at the press conference he said, the only terrorist organization I was ever affiliated with was the U.S. military when I was drafted and sent to the front lines of Vietnam. And let's also be clear, I represent the War Resisters International, a secular nonviolence organization. But much more than that, Adolfo Perez Esquivel, the founder of the South American white Christian pacifist group, Servicio Paz y Justicia, you know, he wrote in to us in the last month saying, look, I want to be there in San Juan with Oscar. I want to welcome him. He is the Mandela of the Americas. It turned out Adolfo couldn't physically be there, but he sent messages along with other noted pacifists, Marriott Corrigan Maguire, the Northern Irish Nobel Peace Prize winner of the group Peace People, said, please give Oscar an extra big hug from me. And this is not a group who's naively thinking that they're supporting a Puerto Rican pacifist. On the other hand, let's also be clear. I think in most places outside of the fragmented, dichotomized U.S. white left, I'll say, there's a more dialectical understanding about strategies and tactics and about violence and nonviolence. So I think, you know, we are great at creating our own really hurtful mythology. And so on the one hand, yes, I think By Any Means Necessary is a vital rubric, a call, a cry, obviously a quote of Minister Malcolm's. But also, you know, there has been room. There has been plenty of room in the Oscar movement for people who would not themselves take up armed struggle, who did consider themselves or do consider themselves pacifists, noted human rights leaders, but who didn't for a moment hesitate to join the campaign, saying, amongst other things, it's time to bring him home. He's done enough time. It's been torturous, inhumane treatment. But also saying, we understand that it is not our job to determine for the Puerto Rican people how they will wage their struggle. Self-determination is a key principle of solidarity. And if we're going to be in solidarity with one another, if we are going to cross borders and lines, if we are going to take down the walls that some would have us build up between peoples, we're going to have to do that by letting people determine their own realities, name their own realities, determine the strategies, tactics, ideologies of their own struggles. And if we go around, especially as North Americans, especially as the white imperialists, especially as the colonizers, then we are going to, as past movements, not even get off the ground. And I think if we're going to learn anything from the lessons of the so-called 60s, you know, that period of time from somewhere in the early 1950s to the late 1970s, if we're going to learn anything from the 80s and 90s, we're going to have to learn that solidarity means a two-way street. We have as much in the global north to learn from the people's movements of Puerto Rico, of New Africa, of the African, Asian, and South American continents, or the peoples of the Pacific and the Caribbean. We have as much to learn from them as we have solidarity to give them. And if we don't do it on the basis of self-determination, then it's a non-starter.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good, very good point there. And you know, one other thing about Oscar that I think is sort of relevant to a lot of things that we're talking about today. He's also a popular educator, helped form an alternative school and part of sort of a broader movement amongst Black and Latino people in, you know, early 70s to sort of reclaim what was taught in the school. And you know, it just reminded me to think of when we think of the role of education and knowledge in terms of both advancing liberation and holding it back, that I think a large part of the sort of quote-unquote left or progressive conversation about education is, you know, whether it should be a private school or a public school. And I'm not saying that's not a relevant issue, the charter school issue, but it almost seems like we've lost the thread of what's taught in the school and the importance of that kind of counter-hegemonic education for creating an environment of growth for popular movements. And I just thought that's another part of Oscar's legacy I think is worth reflecting on when we're talking about, you know, relevance to today's movement.
It's a good point. And I think, yes, I mean, that education for empowerment, the idea that education is a lifelong pursuit. It's not about teachers and students. It's about, you know, we're all students in that sense. And so, yes, you know, you make me think of the Puerto Rican high school, Pedro Vizu Campos Puerto Rican High School. And Oscar's there now. You know, we were together in San Juan yesterday, but this morning, after a day with his people, Oscar flew into Chicago, where he's giving an address. You know, he chose on his second day to go to Chicago, which was where so much community organizing was done by himself, his brother, and the community members they built with, and still exists to this day. He's also, by the way, going to be touring through the U.S. and through every province of Puerto Rico. He says he likes to listen, and listening to what his people on the island and in the diaspora have to say is a priority in this next period. And I think it's important to know that he made a decision to set up his own foundation, that he's going to essentially not work, you know, for any political party or in any particular existing structure, but the Fundación Oscar López Rivera Libertad will be the space that he's going to be working with and raising money for and trying to build some new consensus, some new educational opportunities, some new alternative ways of doing what we've been trying to do for a long time, but in this new context of 2017, 2018, and this new period.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. That's a great point to leave it on. That was Matt Meyer. Thank you again for being on the show, Matt. And we are going to leave it there for By Any Means Necessary here today.
By any means necessary.